Good afternoon. This is my headset isn't up. Can you? You can hear me on the mic? Okay. Well, this is Larry McAtee, and this is Home Again with Home Team. Home Team Inspection. We're a full service inspection company, and we're coming to you live from Huntington County Radio. And today, and let me get a few things straight. We just had to start our live stream there for a minute, and we're up and running now. But let's talk about the weather real quick. The weather today is going to be a high of 71, partly cloudy. Tomorrow, high of 72, sunny. Friday, high of 80, sunny. Saturday and Sunday, both 87 degrees with partly sunny, and Monday, 87 again. So it looks like we're going to do for 5-6 days of nice weather in the upper 80s, and then Tuesday we're looking at a little rain. So get your plans out, get some things done, and start that fall service projects, get them done. I'll be right back after we do a couple commercials. My guest today is Joe DiPompeo, right? I'm sorry, I know I stuttered over that. Joe is a structural engineer, and he's president of Structural Workshops, right? Yeah, and we're going to be talking about structural things today. And in light of that deck collapse and down in Cape May, we'll be talking about decks initially, and then we'll take it to wherever it goes. So stay with us. We'll be back in a couple minutes with the commercials. So stay with us right now.
Hey, Pat, did you know between the two of us, we know how to screw in a light bulb?
Come on, Steve. We can do better than that. Well, at least I can. Tell you what, you sit there and look pretty, and I'll fix it.
Listen to you, big guy. Better yet, let's get everyone to listen to Home Sweet Home with me, Steve Bailey, Inspector with Brass Tack Home Inspections.
And I'm Pat Gregory, Handyman Extraordinaire with Taskman Home Improvements, every Friday at 11 a.m. Or you can go to our archives and get access to over 50 podcasts. We cover the basement to the attic and everything in between.
You can even call us at 908-237-0410 during our radio program about our home improvement projects. Remember, Home Sweet Home, every Friday at 11 on Huntington Chamber Radio.
From the basement to the attic, you're listening to Steve and Patrick. Home sweet home.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Huntington Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@huntington-chamber.org.
All right, I'm back. This is Larry McAtee and it's Home Team. Home again with Larry, Jeannie and Larry, and Jeannie's my counterpart every other week, and she's from Wykert Realtor. Today I'm with Joe DiPompeo. And he's a structural engineer. But before I get to that, just a little bit about, how every week we start with a little story, in a sense, so you get to know. My son, as we have spoke about before, has autism, and he's 27. And this past weekend, they had a surfing down in Belmar, and there's a group called Surfers Healing. And it's amazing. It's a group of guys out of California, professional surfers that travel the world, spending 200 days a year surfing with kids with disabilities. And there's some video on Facebook up there of my son. They took six guys to get the vest on him, but then they got the vest on him. They got him out on a board, and then he comes in and he hanged 10 on a big board a couple of times, and he loved it. And my hat's off to these guys because they literally thank the parents for bringing their kids out because they get such a reward out of teaching these kids how to surf and giving them the real-life experiences. I can't explain it. As a parent, you're just happy to see that Matt did something that's sort of normal in a sense. And then for a few minutes there in the ocean with these guys, he was experienced life that I don't know that he does all the time. And what a great group of guys. And New Jersey Autism, who threw the Beach Bash. We all worried about the hurricane coming in because last year it was canceled because of the hurricane. This year we had it. But with that, down the shore now. Joe, we want to talk about, first of all, Joe, tell us where you're from. And I mean, you got a lot of letters after your names. I know you're structural engineer is what I like to know about. But you want to talk right into that mic for me?
Sure,
right?
Sure. Yes, my name is Joe DiPompeo, and I am a structural engineer, as you said. My company is Structural Workshop. We've been in business over 15 years. Our main office is in Parsippany, we opened a second office in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is, I guess, a little bit closer to where we are today. We are a full-service engineering firm. We work on projects all over the country, sizes, anything from a small sizing a beam in a house to mid-rise buildings and heliports and hospitals. And we do just about everything. No high-rises or highway bridges. Other than that, we do just about everything. But when I started the business, I was looking to get into whatever businesses I could get into, because obviously it was a new business and we needed to make money. So one of the things I had gotten into was home inspections, which you do. In the course of doing that, I met some home inspectors and was hearing from a lot of them that they were having a very hard time finding structural engineers to give referrals to when they found a structural problem in a house. It was very easy to find an electrician and other types of professionals to give referrals to, but structural engineers were hard because they were either one-man shows that were working out of their house, or they were moonlighting and they weren't very professional or qualified, or they were bigger companies that either didn't have experience looking at stuff like this or didn't want to touch it for just business reasons or insurance reasons. So
it's difficult because some of the things I present to a structural engineer – it's almost like a mason. You know, he doesn't want to do half a job either because, you know, his name's going to be on it after you leave. So it's a unique person that can go in and just answer the questions that we need. Right. So I appreciate that.
So we started with going after that market and trying to fill that niche, and we've done very well at it. I mean, there's weeks we do 10 visits and reports a week, and it's about 20% of my business, 25% of my business, depending on the year. Personally, I've done thousands of them. I have staff that's done hundreds of them. So
does it lead you to other business? I mean, sometimes you do the repair work.
Correct.
Is that what you know?
Correct. We'll design the repairs. Our goal, and this is one of the selling points, as you've heard at talks I've given. I mean, our goal is to get in there quickly within a couple days. Find out what's going on, what the ramifications of that are, what the potential costs of that are, and get all that information to the client so they can make a decision about the real estate transaction. They can ask for credits. They can ask for repairs. I mean, that's the initial goal, and we do that independently of anything that may come after. Because
that's what I lose in a lot of professionals, because I'll get some electricians who say, oh, I'll get here 3 weeks from now.
Right.
Well, we're dealing with a real estate transaction. We're talking about days, not weeks.
Correct, and we understand that.
And I agree with you. I love the fact that you guys get right in there and get the answers to the client, because many times I tell them if it's a structural thing, I'd rather get them get concession and have it done under their watch if they feel comfortable with it, because then they can control the otherwise people will take the easiest fix.
And the easiest fix
might not be the best fix.
Correct. There's pros and cons to both. I mean, if you're doing it under your watch, you have the risk of it overruns,
right,
or finding new problems. The best scenario if you're a buyer would be to do it while the other people still own the house, but have your own. And we've done this rarely, but occasionally people can get this worked out where we would be working for the buyer. We would design the repairs and produce a set of drawings, and the sellers would do it while they own the house, and
right,
we would check up on it and make sure it was done right, and then that transfers all the risk to the sellers.
Yeah, and that's the same thing we do with mold remediation. We'll have the scope of work will be developed by the buyer, but then the homeowner will execute it.
Right. That's ideal.
But I love the fact that you'll respond to that, because I have roofers, and I'll say, listen, I need an opinion on this. I'll say 3 weeks, or it's too small, I don't want to do it. Well, you know, people buying the house, they need to make an educated decision now. And Joe has indicated, I've heard him speak before, and the home inspectors, I think, respect him because he also respects us. I mean, too many professionals out there, like electrician, will go and say, "Oh my God, why did he say?" You know, I'm a generalist. I mean, you're my cardiologist, Joe. I've used that analogy before. I see a structural problem. I can identify a structural question. I'm not sure if it's right or wrong, but then I say, "Listen, I want you to see Joe. I want you to see a structural guy to confirm whether it's okay or not." It's like your doctor. I mean, your doctor discovers a heart murmur. He's not going to fix it. He's not going to diagnose it. He's going to send you to a specialist. And you're that specialist, and I appreciate the fact. I mean, I've had some specialists look at my back, and the guy tells me, 3 months before I can see him. Well, what good is that? My back hurts today.
Correct.
So you're in a unique position, and I appreciate that the fact that you do it that way, because I come across a lot of things, and one of my biggest fears will transition to decks here is the higher the deck gets off the ground, the more the hair in the back of my neck stands up. When I look at a house that I'm going to do, and I see the deck on Zillow, and I see it's 14 feet in the air, and it's got 6x6 posts, and it's extended 22 feet from the house, I start sweating a little bit, because that's big exposure.
Correct. I mean, decks are one of the things that does collapse, and obviously the timing on the show we're doing today, there were two news stories over the past couple of days, one in Wildwood, which got a lot of attention, and another one in Summit, which got a little attention. But we get asked a lot by skittish buyers or skittish owners, is this going to collapse? Is this safe? And the typical response is, we have very high standards for structures, and it's very, very rare where a house or a building will actually collapse. When it does, you see it on the news, obviously. And I always tell people that just because we're pointing out a problem, 99% of the problems that we identify, they're economic risks to people. They're not safety risks in terms of an immediate hazard.
Sure.
But the exception, there's two exceptions I usually give as examples. One is flat roofs in commercial type of buildings, and the issues we see with them are clogged drains and what's called ponding that could be in conjunction with snow or ice or just rain or rain, snow, and ice combined. But when the drains get clogged and water starts pooling on the roof, the weight of that water causes the roof to deflect or sag. And now that the roof is deflected, you have a deeper pool, basically, and it becomes a self-fulfilling process where as it gets deeper, it weighs more, which allows more water to make it deflect even more, and eventually it collapses. I mean, that's a legitimate safety concern. And the other is residential decks, which various reasons, which we'll get into, do fail on a much more frequent basis than the profession or building inspectors or anybody really would be okay with or have.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest fear is to have my name on one of those decks in a sense. And there's a lot of reasons why you can't predict them. I mean, we talked a little bit before the show about the ones in Cape May. I mean, were enclosed. And if I was inspecting that house, you can't see anything. Everything's in vinyl and aluminum. You can't see how it's attached to the house. You can't see whether the flashing was good or bad. You can't see whether they use nail screws or drywall screws. And, you might laugh at that, but I've seen some decks put on houses with drywall screws, and it gives me chills, because people build their own decks. I mean, and they do it without permits at times. And just because they got a permit doesn't mean it's right either.
Correct. And, I mean, in the past 15 years or so, with the advent of the IBC codes, The deck requirements have gotten much more stringent, and the inspectors are paying a lot more attention, and that helps. And I think decks have a limited life, so eventually most of the decks out there will be built under the new codes and inspected and built properly. But the first issue is what you're getting at. I mean, there's a wide range of construction styles, types, and quality for decks that, depending on when they were built, whether they got permits, who built it. There are plenty of decks out there that somebody was feeling handy and went to Home Depot on a Saturday morning and over the course of a couple weekends built the deck and never told anyone, never had it inspected, never had it permitted, and they may know what they're doing, they may not know what they're doing. That's the first problem.
I find the biggest problem there is they may know what they're doing to build the deck for their family, but they'll build a 14-foot deck by 20 feet, and then but it's not built for 50 people.
Correct. That's another – correct. There's a list of problems.
That deck may never fail on a normal use, but they have the kid's first birthday, and they have 100 people over their house, and 30 of them are out in the deck. People don't understand the residence and the weight and all that. And
right. I would put that as the last on the list, but that's usually the item that causes it to collapse, but – there's several things to get there first, and one is what we just discussed, and the second is decks are outside. They're exposed to weather. They age. They rot. The
bugs.
Bugs and the connections that are metal, if they're not galvanized or corrosion resistant, they'll rust. So that's the second issue. And the third is the critical connection of a deck is at the ledger board, where the deck is actually connected to the house. There's very, very few decks that are completely freestanding. Almost all of them are. There's a board that's attached into the house, and then the framing comes out to some posts that are further out.
Sure.
That, you know, especially these multi-story, relatively narrow decks like the one that was in Wildwood. I mean, they're right. They're just ledger boards, and you got some two-bys spanning 8-10 feet, and then there's a railing, and
right.
That's the whole deck. So if the ledger board fails, that's everything half fell. Of it. It goes. So the ledger board connections are the newer codes are very clear on how and what you can do, because that is a major source of failure. But the not only is how they were done through the years varies tremendously, but it's also exposed to weather, and it's also a hidden connection. The actual anchors from the ledger board into the house are really, you can only see the front of the screw, nail, bolt, whatever it is. The actual piece that passes behind the ledger board, that's mixed in where the flashing is, the siding is.
I don't know whether that leg, well, even that leg bolt snapped in half when I was putting it in.
Correct. Or how far it goes into the house, or if it's rusted. There's all sorts of variables.
I've had a lot of hangers lately that are rusted through.
Correct.
They were galvanized, and they're still rusted through.
So, I mean, and there's been issues with the corrosion resistance on the hangers not being compatible with the corrosion resistance on the fasteners, and that causing a galvanic reaction or something along those lines, that even though you have galvanized members, they still corrode. I know the Simpson products, they make special coatings to address that. But so you take all those things, and then you overload the deck, as you described, and you get sudden failures, which we were talking about earlier. That's the other problem with decks. It's not something that you necessarily see coming. This is a sudden and catastrophic collapse.
I tell homeowners, I said, decks don't fail one board at a time. They typically fail catastrophically. With that, we're going to be right back. We're going to continue with decks, but I got to hit a couple commercials right here at this break. So hang on, and we'll be right back. Let me hit the right button here.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Okay, we're back. I'm here with Joe DiPompeo, and we're talking structural engineering, and we're talking decks specifically. I love having a structural engineer on. I could keep him here all day, guys, because I see things all day long that I wish he was in my back pocket. But unfortunately,
that's probably the first time anyone ever said that about a structural engineer.
well, a good home inspector, and I think you've recognized it too, is he doesn't sell us out either. He doesn't walk in and say, "Oh, you missed this, you missed that." He recognizes the fact that we are limited in a sense of our knowledge, and even if I have extensive knowledge, because I don't have a license, it's really malpractice if I start giving structural advice. That's why I leave it to the professionals. The same thing I do with a plumber and a licensed electrician. I mean, there's a reason electricians go to school for 7 years, you know? I mean, so anyway, well, let's continue talking about decks. We were talking a little bit about cantilever decks, and this is one thing that I find all the time. It's a pet peeve of mine is, you know, people don't understand what a cantilever deck is. It's where you have the second floor sticks out 2 or 3, 4 feet from the top, from the bottom floor. And it sticks out, and then they attach the deck onto the end of the rim joist. And when you think about that, you're building the half the deck, or more than half the deck, on a cantilevered portion of the deck on a rim joist that's just nailed to the end of the joist.
Right. There's two issues or two types of cantilevered decks. Okay. One is the one you just described. It was allowed and common to attach the ledger board of the deck to a cantilevered portion of the house. But again, with the newer codes in the IBC, that is not allowed anymore. You would have to independently support that. I mean, the issue is not only do you still have all the same issues with the ledger board connection, but you're also permanently loading the tip of that cantilever with the weight of the deck, and you know, that can create issues with the framing in the house. And so I mean, that's not allowed. As I said, as more and more older decks get replaced because they have a limited life, the newer ones for the most part are being built under the new code.
So let me ask you: is a good fix for those adding the post and beam?
Yeah, that's very. From a technical perspective, it's a good fix, and it's a simple fix. I mean, it's not that expensive to add a beam, a couple posts, and footings. The issue is what's underneath, and what space are you destroying underneath? That?
Yeah. But many a time I find that the space underneath is wide open.
It can be, can be a patio. You know, it depends. There can be a septic. We've had decks over septic fields where you have to. We had a commercial deck, a restaurant on a lake that. Had some design issues, and we had to retrofit and reinforce it, but there was a whole septic field underneath it. So it was very limited on where we could get any columns or footings in. The second issue with cantilever decks is a type of deck that was very popular in, like, apartment type of buildings in, you know, the 60s and 70s, where the actual the deck joist would cantilever out of the building.
I see a lot of those.
They'd go in 15 feet and then be sistered and come through, and it would be a freestanding balcony, essentially, that had no posts, no ledger board, nothing. Right. But the problem is they're very, very difficult to properly waterproof, and almost all of them
get rot at the
connection to the house. Yeah. And they're almost impossible to repair or fix is the problem without tearing the interior of the house apart.
That's a good point, because I find those and I really pick at the joint. Mm-hmm. But I tell people I can't tell. For every foot outside, it's supposed to be 2 feet inside, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's
that's the standard, right? Yeah. So, I mean, if it sticks out 4 feet, it's supposed to have 8 feet. I said that's supposed to go across your living room ceiling.
Correct. Yeah.
And it may not or may, but I can't see that.
Sometimes you can pick it up because if there'll be a hump in the floor. Because as the weight of the deck outside, the back end of that kicks up a little bit. Yeah. But it's occasionally.
I see it sometimes when I have an exposed basement and you know, like a bi-level. You'll see downstairs, and I see that the joist comes all the way in.
Right.
But it's a question that and you can't predict it. I mean, that's why I tell people, you feel movement, that's the time to call for help. I mean,
obviously, anything that's moving, without a doubt. I mean, that's probably well beyond the point to call for help. But that's obviously
the first thing you know is you feel a weakness in there, you feel a change, call. Don't wait.
Right. Correct.
I mean, how do you size a deck for, like, the amount of people on it? I mean, I always chuckle in a way because I think of elevators. You get an elevator that says 1,800 pounds, and then you look around and there's 10 guys in an elevator, and there are 10 guys like me. I'm saying, well, we're well over the 1,800 pounds.
Typically, any kind of building code or design code or design standard, there's factors of safety to account for. Errors in construction, not building things exactly as planned, material defects. So typically on an elevator or something, it might be double. I mean, to failure. So there's different ways you can set a factor of safety. You can do what's an allowable determinant.
Yeah, but how do I know? I have a 20 by 14 deck in the back of my house. How do I know how many people I should put on that deck?
Well, From a building code perspective, the deck has to have the same loading as the occupancy it serves. So if it's serving a residence, it has the 40-pound live load that the residence has. If it's serving a public occupancy, retail, restaurant, it's a 100-pound live load. So that would be the design load. If you wanted to work backwards and you have a deck on your house and you want to have a big party, we actually just had a situation like this where it's rare that we do things this way, but this wasn't a deck. It was a mezzanine in a commercial building that they were having.
Well, the only reason I think of like that deck down in Cape May, and I've been down to Fireman's Convention, and you know, that deck might have been there for 10 years. It might have been there for another 20 if the people renting their condo only sat out there. But more than likely, they had more people there, and I've been at, you know, seen decks wall-to-wall people.
Right. Well, this was a... it's analogous, so I want to just talk a little bit about it, but then I'll get into how it relates to your question.
Okay.
This was a mezzanine in a building, and they wanted to have some classes and events on it that were going to have a lot of people on it. So we were brought in to basically reverse figure out if they could have X amount of people on it. So we had to determine the capacity of the mezzanine. So if you relate that to the deck, you can measure up the members, the size, the spacing, the spans, and figure out what the maximum capacity under the building code that they're allowed to have is. And then, I mean, once you have that, you'll get to what's a pounds per square foot rating, which is how many pounds per square foot of area the deck can hold. How that relates to people, I mean, it's there is no provision in the building code to do that, but it's pretty intuitive. If it's a 100-pound live load per square foot, and you're going to pack it like sardines, you figure a person takes up two square feet. That's, you can have 200 pounds in those 2 square feet. So that just kind of an idea how that relates.
Sure.
So, a residential deck, if you had people tight on that entire deck, you're probably going to be well over the 40 pounds per square foot.
Sure,
but
sure.
You know, the building code doesn't account for every single possibility. I mean, most residential decks have 2-3 people on them. You know,
on the average,
right,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you might have a family of 5, but you're not going to have. But that time you have that graduation party, and you know, that's one of the things you see in the news, though.
Right, exactly.
It's not the family of 5 having dinner on the deck. It's a graduation party, or it's a college party. I mean,
exactly.
You know, and I warned my kids when they went to college about decks and crowds and.
Right.
You know, and I explained to them live loads in a building, like even a fire code. There's a reason why there's a number by the door saying 300 people in this building.
Right.
I told my daughter, you go to a bar or a party and it says 300 people and there's well more than 300, don't go in.
Correct.
Because 300 is even 300 is going to be a nightmare getting out.
Correct.
But any more than 300, you're not going to get out. Right. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
They think fire people do that for, you know, just to bust chops,
right.
But there's a reason for it. Yes. I mean, just like you're rating in the deck.
Yes, correct. I mean, I'm generally against onerous regulations, but there are reasons that a lot of
safety
regulations,
yes,
and codes are in place. I mean, think most regulations we have, something happened that, you know, caused the need for that regulation,
right.
Like a failure. I mean, structural engineers, we're constantly evaluating. When something fails, it's a constant evaluation as to what happened, why, and how do we prevent it.
Well, you know, down at Cape May, there's a lot of people looking at that structure right now.
Oh, there will, yeah.
And, you know, nobody died, thank God.
Yes.
But there are some people hurt, and I don't know how seriously, but nobody died. But, I mean, there's going to be a lot of people, and there's a lot of inspectors, both probably private and civil, that are sweating a little bit because they're going to look at this and see what could have been done, when could it have been done.
Like
you talked before about visual. I wouldn't want my name attached to it, even though I think that I wouldn't be culpable because I'd say I couldn't see it. But you know what? That doesn't make you feel any better.
Correct. I mean, it might ultimately get you off the hook in the end.
Exonerate.
But you're
going to
go through the same litigation everyone else that ever even walked by the deck is going to go through.
And you're also feeling guilty. I would feel very guilty if I. You know, I feel very proud when I find something that if you come in and say, yes, he was right, you need to re-support this. This is an issue. I mean, I think HGTV has done us a disservice in some ways because they show you ripping out walls and this and that. And then halfway through the show, oh, my God, you need a beam. And I'm thinking, well, I could have told you that in the first 5 seconds. I mean, I don't need.
Like much reality TV.
I know.
Overhyped and staged.
But a lot of people don't understand that, you know,
correct.
They're bearing walls and stuff like that. That, you know, I somebody the other day said to me, the woman said, well, I'm going to take this wall out. I said, well, you're going to need an architect and you're going to need an engineer because that's your ridge beam, and you know you're not taking it out. I mean, truss construction. I mean, you know, people think, oh, it's not a bearing wall, but it's truss construction. I said, well, then you just can't take the truss out without getting an engineering's okay.
Yeah, we see a lot of that. That might be another topic to touch on is
trusses.
Prefabricated trusses in attics that people want to put a hatch in or want to make storage, and they just start hacking stuff up. I mean,
two things. I was a fireman here in town, and I saw many of people put folding stairs in a truss construction, and they cut through the 2x4s, and I explained to them when they cut one 2x4, they compromised the whole roof.
Correct. That truss at least.
Well, right? but usually a compromise because the other ones are under stress now.
Correct.
So as a fireman, I look at a broken truss is a scary part because it can compromise the catastrophe.
Correct.
Because they rely on each other and they rely on interior pressure. I mean, people don't understand that it's designed for the snow load up top. And they put plywood down and put 800 pounds of stuff on the truss.
Exactly. I mean, a third item that does fail is bowstring trusses, which were very, very popular in, you know, 40s through 60s. I mean, bowling alley type of structures. Think of those big barrel arch roofs with the heavy timbers. There has been a lot of failures of them for a lot of reasons, which, you know, we won't get into today because it's really not
commercial
to homeowners. But trusses... You know, those trusses especially can fail, and it's the same thing. A truss is an entire system where every piece and every connection is designed to only do a certain thing and to do what it's supposed
and
to do.
And work together.
And when, when anything changes, you could have stress reversals where members that were in compression are now in tension and they're not designed for that, or vice versa, or you could have connections that are designed to only resist certain forces in certain directions, and that changes. So trusses typically fail by a cascading process, where if you cut a member, now another member goes into compression, and it's not supposed to be, so it buckles, and now that member has no value, which causes another member to be overstressed,
and that's what I said.
That one goes.
In 1990, we bought an aerial here in Raritan Township. It was a bucket, and it had 110-foot reach, and people were up in arms at first because they said we had nothing 10 stories high, and I said it's for the reach.
Right.
And they didn't understand when you're at a condo association, you're 35-foot setback, you're a row of cars, you're already now 50 feet from where you can get a truck.
Right.
And we're not stepping on that roof for that reason. The condo was built with 2x4s, and you know, even though they're very sturdy when they're working together, you have a fire inside. A 2x6 burns through in 2 hours. A 2x4 can burn through in 20 minutes.
I think a lot of them are labeled now, aren't they? They have a label that says truss construction.
Well, you'll see a T and a triangle on most buildings that are truss constructions. And even the bowstring. So if you ever see that on the side of a building, it's usually a blue triangle and it says T. That's identifying that a fire company is truss construction. But a good fire department, to tell you the truth, it knows the area. And you pre-plan it, like we pre-plan, you know, condos and the commercial buildings. We know what type of roofs they have, just for that reason, because you don't want to find out when you're doing it. But it goes back to what you said, and it was a rude awakening for me because I didn't understand that either. I mean, I had been in many condo attics, and I see, oh my God, there's like a room up there, and I'm like, you know, and I'm seeing all these gusher plates cut, and I'm like, well, you know, this is a red flag.
Correct. Yeah, that's an immediate red flag. There's certain issues that are just. Very clear answer, and with a cut truss, it's always either have to restore the truss, which is the simplest, or if it's a scenario where they put an attic hatch in and they absolutely need it, you have to reinforce
things around there.
Correct.
I tell people if there's a cut in anything in their attic and it's a truss, they need an engineer's letter on top of that.
Yeah.
They need to say that the stress was redesigned and handled appropriately.
Yeah.
And there are times, like you said, where you can do it. But you might have to add, you know, extra 2x4s here, and it's not easy because 2x4s and the gusser plates and everything else, you know, it's best left alone. I mean, we do have to have access to attics, but
And your point about the storage is good too. I've seen people who just use members that are not intended for anything but to be part of the truss system, and they lay plywood on them and start storing stuff on them. And I've seen people do the worst of all, where they'll cut members in order to make room for the shelves, and then lay the shelves on
it. And they'll put their own 2x4 in to replace it. And I'm like, well, that's a straight 2x4. The other one was on an angle, and there's
and
a reason it's on an angle.
Yeah, correct, exactly. So.
And I had a house, actually, I did a seller's inspection up in Andover, and literally I went in the master bedroom, and the ceiling was separating from the ceiling, I mean the walls.
Mm.
I go in the attic, and the guy was a hoarder, and the attic was packed solid from soffits to gable with weight. I mean, heavy things, records and books, lots of books. And I said, this is the reason your ceiling's buckling.
Right.
I said, this, yeah, although this was an attic and it was a walk-up attic, you could store stuff, but it was way overloaded.
Yeah, correct. They're not.
It wasn't designed for that.
Even attics with storage, if you look in the building code, they're not. And, I mean, that sounds more almost like a library. I mean, the type of loading you'd get.
Well, he had shelves, and it was like packed solid. Yeah. And I said, you know, that's the reason why when you go to build a second floor sometimes, people say, well, why do I got to put 2x10s in? Because they have 2x6s right now, and it's not designed for a floor.
Correct.
Same thing, guys.
Attics have a inaccessible attics, and there's attics with limited access and limited storage. That means, you know, maybe you can kind of crawl around in there and throw a couple boxes around, and then there would be a full attic, which would almost be designed for residential loads, but those are rare. Most attics are designed for loads that are not going to be okay to use as a bedroom or a living space. You'd have to sister.
Well, in most of the ceilings now, you can't walk, and I always say the architects – They're probably sitting back laughing because they always build the attics like 1 foot too high, too low, so I have to crawl. If they build it 1 foot higher, I could walk along the attic and look. But it's just that little bit too short where I gotta literally end up crawling across the beams to see the attic. And, you know, people wonder why home inspectors go in the attic is because that's when we see that kind of work. I mean, somebody put a skylight in, and I had one the other day. They put a skylight in, but they cut through four trusses. And it wasn't even boxed out. And I'm like, you know, the skylight looked beautiful, and you know what? It wasn't failing; everything was fine. But you know, when people say, "Well, you're making a mountain out of a molehill," I might be.
Attics are in many houses the only place you can see the framing. So even if you can't see the framing, but you're seeing cracks, you're seeing movement. If you can see the framing in the attic, at least it gives you an indication as to the quality of the work and whether things are sized correctly. Sometimes indirectly, you can pick up a lot of things from looking in an attic.
Oh, yeah. And people don't understand. That's why I insist on getting into them. And when I can't, like there are times where I got to the house and there's no access. They covered it up. I said, you really want to have access before you close.
Correct.
And they went, what do you mean? I'm like, well, my report's going to say it's severely limited because I can't see any of your structure.
Right. Or you have a 2-foot by 2-foot hatch in the,
2 foot is generous.
The corner of a closet that, you know, you or me would need to cover ourselves in Crisco to get through.
Well, you might be able to, but I tell you what, there's been some I go through that I have to take my belt off to get my tool belt to get through, and then getting back through is even harder.
Yeah.
I mean, I had one the other day in a pantry, and it was probably 18 by 20, and I literally could only get my head and shoulders into it, and I could take some pictures, but that was it. But
I highly recommend investing in a tactical flashlight, the high...
I have a tactical. Yeah, it's $400 flashlight.
So many holes and crawl spaces and attics and places that I would not want to go in that having that allows me to stick my head in the hatch and light the whole
The other thing is good is a good camera with a good strong flash.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. I tell people, I may see something when I go home because you take some high-definition pictures with a flash, you go home and you blow them up, and then you can zoom in. It's tremendous. Today, technology has given us a lot. I mean, let's talk about one thing that I find a lot of that I would like personally to get some information is steel posts. You mentioned it when you taught us the class about the steel posts and how they're only like a 16th of an inch thick. And I have quite a few that have blistering rust on them. When do I call it out as a structural failure or something that has to be looked at? Or is it normal to have some rust? I mean, mine have some rust, but I can't chip at it. But I had one the other day where I think I was chipping. I think I was actually picking at the concrete. The steel was gone.
Right. Well, I mean, what you're referring to are lally columns, which are what's typically found in houses.
In the basement beam.
Occasionally, you'll see an actual steel post, and that's a structural steel member. It's either square or round. It's a quarter inch or thicker, and it's hollow inside.
No, these are big four, usually 4-inch.
Correct.
They're really nailed to the center beam.
Right, so that's a lally column, which is you can buy them at Home Depot off the shelf. They're very common in residential construction. They look like they're steel. They're usually painted red. They have a very thin steel jacket on the outside, and it's filled with concrete. Now the concrete does most of the work because it's a column. It's in compression. The concrete does most of the work. The steel is there for any eccentricities or any kind of concrete is very good in compression, but it has very little tensile strength. So any kind of bending of that column, because it's a little crooked or it's not everything's not perfectly aligned, you'll get tension on the perimeter of the column, and that's what the steel is there for, to be the tension reinforcement like a rebar would be in a concrete structure. So the problem is it's only a 16th of an inch or in that neighborhood, and there's a very thin space between the steel and the concrete. So you get what's called capillary action, which any water that's below, that's either coming from below the slab, or a lot of times you'll see it in garages where water comes off car tires or ice melts. That's even worse because there's usually salt mixed in with it. That can get sucked up. I mean, we've seen columns that the top of them, like right by the ceiling.
I was just saying, my father-in-law's house, it drips from the top.
Yeah, correct.
There's a little pinhole up near the top, and it literally beads up and comes out there. And I'm like, is the groundwater that high, or
it's
being pushed up?
You take a straw and you put your finger over the top and pull the straw up. It sucks.
But is that something to worry about?
Well, the problem is once the steel rusts, anything beyond surface rust is going to rust through because it's a very thin jacket of steel. Once that happens, it loses any of that the value that the steel added to reinforcing. Granted, very similar to our discussion on decks where it's a sudden and catastrophic collapse. Now, granted, you could have all the steel gone, and if the concrete's perfectly straight and that column is always 100% just in compression, you may never have an issue. But the problem is you have very limited extra capacity for any kind of eccentricity or movement or anything.
So I would think in California it would probably be a bigger issue to say than here.
Well, for a seismic event, obviously,
because because we don't have as much lateral movement.
But there's other things that could cause you to have eccentricity in the column,
Your furniture upstairs.
Even if it's just even if it's not perfectly straight, or the load's not applied right on the center, if it's offset by half an inch, in one direction from the beam that's sitting on it, that'll put eccentricity on it.
So you call it a lolly column. I always thought a lolly column was those temporary ones that we see all the time that, you buy and you put the pins in and you screw it up and you turn the screw at the top.
Well, I think lolly is like a brand name that's kind of become the generic term for it. But
So the steel poles, they're lolly columns too in a sense.
The ones that are concrete filled are lolly columns.
See, I always thought they were the hollow ones those are the ones that we see and we call out that you need a structural engineer because if who decided to put that, screw jack in the floor to take the squeak out?
Those are typically intended for temporary shoring where you can put it in place, tighten it up, and then loosen it and take it back at some point. I have seen them used permanently.
When they can be adjusted, if they can be locked in, you can weld the top and you can put the bolts
in.
I
still don't like to see that, but you don't want anything that can be, adjusted at some point, but
it's a little bit more permanent when you make it permanent. Right.
Regardless of whether it's a lolly column or a screw column or any of those, they're generally always called out and they're always an issue. It's the low hanging fruit for home inspectors and for structural engineers when somebody's looking to negotiate. That's always it's like a given that's going to be called out. And I tell people that even if I don't think it's a big deal, this is going to get called out all the time, so you don't want to necessarily buy this house because then when you go to sell it, you're going to have the same problem. So you might as well address it now.
Right.
They're typically, if you're doing a couple of them, $1,000 a piece to replace, even if you have to put a new footing, and they're not a tremendously expensive item, is the good news. So, as I said, you can buy them off the shelf.
It's more labor than anything because
you've
got to cut through the concrete floor. And people think you can put a post on your floor, and I keep telling them the floor in the basement's not structural. It's 3 inches of concrete that's poured after the fact.
Correct. I mean, there's some capacity in that, but it's not intended
to bear the load on a 4-inch point.
Correct.
And if it truly is a 4-inch load, it could hurt it. We're going to hit a couple commercials, then we're going to come back and wrap up with Joe. So hang on a couple seconds, all right? Thanks.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness
discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterton at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterton, the voice for mental health in Hunterton County.
Hunterton Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterton Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterton Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.huntertonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody just...
Did you know the Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterton-chamber.org. The Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, we're back. I'm back here with Joe DiPompeo from Structural Workshop. Joe's a structural engineer, and we were talking about things about the house. And Joe, I mean, as we found out, that 45 minutes goes fast here, doesn't it? And
yes.
I could keep you here for 3 hours. I guarantee you I could keep you here for a day. And personally, I could use some – I have so many questions for you about what I see out there. But let's talk about little cracks in the basement, because I think that's one of the things that home buyers panic about. And when I would do the foundation outside and I see cracks in the parchment, and one of my rules is that I tell people vertical cracks make me less worried than horizontal ones, because horizontal ones tell me earth pressure and maybe wall collapse, whereas vertical pressure tends to be settlement. And I know I'm not wrong there, but I'm not totally right either. So,
you're pretty much right. There's just more nuance to it, I think, is the way I'd put it. But the first thing to remember is foundations are either constructed with masonry block or poured concrete, and both of them are very brittle materials that have very little flexibility. So, if you examine every foundation in New Jersey, you're going to find almost all of them have some degree of cracking. Just differential expansion and contraction, minor settlement issues. The concrete or the masonry cannot take that without cracking. So a crack in and of itself is not necessarily a problem. Now. Many times there's what's called a parge coat, as you were talking about, where it's a block wall. Then on the outside they put a skim coat of cement so it's nice and smooth. That can crack completely independent of the foundation. So you can have a ton of cracks in the parge coat. You can have the parge coat delaminating, falling off, deteriorating, but zero effect to the actual block wall behind it.
Eventually it might be because it exposes the weather.
Correct. So always with a crack, I mean, regardless of what the major action to take is, the minor action is always to patch it and monitor, meaning seal it. Now you know on whatever day you sealed it that it's sealed tight, and if it 6 months from now reopens to a quarter inch, you know that moved a quarter inch in 6 months. If it stays tight, you know it hasn't moved since you sealed it. So
I tell people, it's my mole principle. I tell them cracks are like moles. You take a picture of it, look at it in 6 months from now, if it's still the same, probably not moving. If it's opening or getting bigger or changing, then maybe you want to understand
correct.
What's
a
moving.
A picture is one way. I mean, there's more formal ways of doing it. There's crack monitors, which are little gauges that have basically rulers on them, and you line up the two sides of it even.
Yeah.
And you glue it to the wall, and then if it moves, it shows you exactly how much and in which direction. That's a little more formal way of doing it. There's also, more electronic versions, but that stuff's more geared.
I've had homeowners put tape on it, masking tape on it, and see if it moves. I mean, and they put a line
or a line,
just a black margin or a Sharpie on it. But I tell them it's the same thing. You just wanted to. I said it's like, you know, it's funny because some people say, well, it's an old house. I said, well, you know, an old house tells me more than a new house. I mean, I could inspect the house that was built last week, and it tells me less about what's going to move than a house that's been there for 40 years.
Correct. So to get to your initial question, though, before we run out of time, horizontal versus vertical cracks. This is always a because everybody has their say on it, and the realtors like to try to head off conversations about it and try to inform their clients. But the general adage is horizontal bad, vertical good. Now there's some truth in where that came from, obviously. Horizontal cracks are typically caused by excessive pressure on the wall. Most cases, that's water. You know, the walls can typically hold the lateral pressure the soil puts on them, but when you add the water pressure on top of that because the soil's saturated, that in many cases will overload the wall and it'll start to bow inward. And you typically, you know, it takes a curved shape, so the inside face of that wall is now longer than it was before, and the masonry can't stretch. As we said, it's a brittle material, so a crack opens up. The conclusion of that process, if it was if you kept loading and loading and loading till the wall fails, is the wall's going to cave in, and that will cause a cave in, and the dirt will cave in, and there's nothing holding the house up above at that point. So, we have seen a lot of failures. It happens in flooding situations a lot. It happens when the conditions change, like the vacant lot behind you gets developed, and they pitch all the water towards your lot, and now you're getting.
I see it on a lot of uphill walls. You know, the most I've seen it, and I haven't seen a lot of them, but when I see them, it's usually in the basement. You know, it's like a walkout basement in front or back, and and so the house is built into the hill.
Right. Yeah,
And I think sometimes it's caused by the backfill because they didn't backfill correctly either.
Or we see too from surcharging, if they have like construction equipment parked directly next to the wall, that surcharge load will put additional horizontal pressure on the wall. So
that's the reason to watch. When I understand when they build your pool.
Yeah,
to make sure
correct.
That they stay away from your foundation because they bring that big tractor and it's going to push on the ground next to your house.
Correct. So those kind of cracks, I mean, they do have the potential for that type of failure. And it's much more – once you start getting that cracking, it's much more likely that it's going to progress to that. So, once you get to a certain point, you have to reinforce the wall. And there's various ways of doing that. The costs depends on, you know, how much it's going to cost depends on what you can do. There's cheap options. There's expensive options. It depends on how severe it is, how the wall's constructed. The vertical cracks are generally caused by differential settlement. Now, you have differential settlement in every house. I mean, if a house uniformly settled, it could drop 8 feet all at once, the entire house, and now you just have a sub-basement. that's but the problem is when
one side or one corner.
Right. Yeah. So when that happens, you get differential settlement. And again, concrete or masonry is a rigid material and it will crack.
But you mentioned before, I tell people if all of a sudden a crack opens up, look outside because maybe the downspout's off and now you're dumping your whole roof.
Horizontal cracks, yeah.
Well, even the vertical one. I mean, all of a sudden you're dumping all your water right in that corner that wasn't dumping for 30 years.
Right, correct. So the vertical cracks, most of them are fine and most of them stop because whatever soil settlement was going on stops before it affects the ability of the foundation to do its job. But the problem is when it continues and becomes a problem, it's generally a very expensive problem to fix. So,
Joe, I hate to cut you off, but we're going to run out of time here. I want you to leave us with your number and an email if you feel like it, because Joe's a great guy to know. I mean, and if you have a question about structural, you've heard him. He I think no job too small, and he's looking for things like that he would look at. But you know, don't underestimate the power of a structural guy, because they're worth their weight in gold to us as a home inspectors, but also to you as homeowners. So if you have a question, Joe, maybe you want to leave your name and number.
Company is Structural Workshop LLC, and we have a very informative website really geared towards homeowners and home buyers. It's www.structuralworkshop.com. That's all one word. We have a lot of articles and blog posts and information that homeowners, home buyers, realtors, home inspectors will find very informative. Mm-hmm. And the phone number is 973-771-6970. And the generic email for the company is info@structuralworkshop.com.
Well, thank you, Joe. I appreciate that. And if you didn't get that information, let me know. I can always get it to you. But, you know, it's a big part of my business, to tell you the truth, is the safety of you and your home. And none of us want to see what happened last weekend. We want to prevent those. Those are the things that, you know, just keep in mind that people aren't trying to spend your money. We're trying to protect you to some degree. And but although you can't predict everything in the world, we can predict some things. And a lot of them, like Joe said before, a lot of those safety regulations are built out of history and experience that people have seen. So if they tell you you need something, it's not because they want to sell you an extra bracket. It's because they want to make your deck safe or your house safe. So with that, we're going to wrap up today. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Jeannie will be back next week. But again, it's Larry from Home Team, 973-547-7748. Give us a call if you need anything. Otherwise, we'll see you then. I hope you enjoyed the show today. And like I said, we'll have Joe back maybe sometime in the near future, because I'm sure there's other things we can talk about. If you have an idea or you want something, let me know and give us a call. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Joe.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heidi and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
USA Radio News with Chris Barnes.
President Trump tweeting earlier today that he's directing the Treasury Chief Steve Mnuchin to, quote, substantially increase sanctions on Iran. Following the attacks on Saudi Arabian oil facilities over the weekend that the U.S. believes Iran is responsible for, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy says those attacks cannot go unanswered.
I think this is a time that the world unites to stop these terrorist actions and stop Iran from harassing the rest of the world.
Longtime diplomat under several presidents, Robert O'Brien.